All right, so you're ready to tackle the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's a topic that can feel a bit overwhelming, right?
It can be.
So many layers of history, archaeology, religion. But don't worry, we're going to unpack it all in this deep dive. We'll uncover those aha moments and connect the dots in a way that makes this ancient world come alive.
Yeah, what's fascinating about the Dead Sea Scrolls is that they don't just add a few details to our understanding of the Bible. They fundamentally challenge our assumptions about the development of Judaism and early Christianity.
Exactly. It's like suddenly having access to a library that's been lost for centuries. We're talking about pushing our knowledge of the Hebrew Bible back by 1,000 years. To put that in perspective, that's like finding a first edition of Shakespeare's plays. It completely changes our understanding of how these texts were formed and transmitted.
And it's not just about the texts themselves. The scrolls also give us a glimpse into a vibrant and complex Jewish community that existed during a pivotal period in history.
Okay, so let's start with the basics. Qumran, where exactly is this place? And why was it such a prime location for preserving these ancient writings?
So picture the northwest corner of the Dead Sea, a rugged, desolate landscape. Limestone cliffs tower over these caves, carved into soft marl and dry riverbeds called Wadi Snake through the terrain. It's a harsh environment, but perfect for preserving scrolls.
So the dryness and lack of sunlight in those caves acted like a natural time capsule.
Exactly. The low humidity and limited exposure to the elements created ideal conditions for preserving these delicate documents. It's remarkable that they survived for so long.
They almost didn't, right?
They almost did.
I mean, the discovery story itself is like something out of an Indiana Jones movie. Bedouin shepherds, antiquities dealers, scrolls being used to repair shoes. It's a story that's as captivating as the scrolls themselves. It all started in the winter of 1947, when a Bedouin shepherd searching for a lost sheep tossed a rock into a cave near Qumran. He heard the sound of pottery shattering and decided to investigate. Can you imagine? You're just looking for a sheep and stumble upon one of the most significant archaeological discoveries of the 20th century.
It's incredible.
It is mind-blowing.
Absolutely. Inside the cave, he found jars filled with ancient scrolls. At first, neither he nor the antiquities dealers he sold them to fully understood their significance.
Wow.
There are even stories of some scrolls being used to repair shoes. Imagine that.
It's almost unbelievable, right? These priceless documents almost lost forever because they were mistaken for scrap material.
Fortunately, some scrolls made their way to scholars who recognized their importance, and the timing of this discovery couldn't have been more dramatic.
Right.
This was 1947, just as the British mandate for Palestine was ending, and the region was on the brink of war.
Talk about adding another layer of intrigue to the story. So, as political tensions were escalating, these scrolls were being shuffled around, almost getting lost in the chaos.
Exactly. It's a testament to the dedication of scholars and collectors that these fragile documents survived this turbulent period.
So, we have these Bedouin shepherds finding the scrolls, and then they end up in the hands of Father Samuel, a Syrian Orthodox priest. What role did he play in preserving these documents?
Father Samuel purchased four of the scrolls, recognizing their potential historical value. However, he was living in the old city of Jerusalem, which quickly became a battleground as fighting erupted between Israelis and Arabs.
So he's trapped in a war zone with these incredibly valuable scrolls.
It was a dangerous situation.
It sounds like a scene from a spy thriller.
He was desperate to protect the scrolls, so he reached out to the American Schools of Oriental Research in Jerusalem. A young scholar named John Trevor was able to photograph the scrolls before they deteriorated further. Those
Wow.
photographs turned out to be invaluable.
What a stroke of luck. So even though the scrolls themselves suffered some damage, we still have a record of their original condition, thanks to those photographs.
Absolutely. It's a good reminder of the importance of careful documentation, especially in archaeology.
But Father Samuel's story doesn't end there, right?
No, it doesn't.
He eventually made it out of Jerusalem
Hmm?
and took the scrolls with him to the United States.
That's right. He ended up in the U.S. hoping to find a buyer for the scrolls and raise funds for the Syrian Orthodox Church. He even placed a small ad in the Wall Street Journal.
Really?
Can you imagine selling ancient scrolls in the classifieds?
That's incredible. What a unique way to sell a historical treasure. And this little ad got the attention of Yigal Yadin,
It did.
the Israeli archaeologist who had already acquired three other scrolls.
Yes, Yadin recognized the significance of reuniting the scrolls and was able to purchase them from Father Samuel in 1954 for $250,000.
Wow.
quite a hefty sum at the time.
So all seven of those initial scrolls ended up in Israel. But this was just the tip of the iceberg, right?
It was.
The discovery of those first scrolls sparked a wave of archaeological activity in the region. And that's when researchers realized that Qumran wasn't just a random storage site.
Exactly. Remember those jars the scrolls were found in? As archaeologists began excavating Qumran, they started finding similar jars there, along with other evidence suggesting a connection between the settlement and the scrolls.
So it became clear that this wasn't just a place where scrolls were hidden away. Qumran was a community, a place where people lived and produced these texts.
And what a community it was. Their beliefs and practices were quite distinct from mainstream Judaism at the time.
Okay, I'm hooked.
Mm.
Let's dive into the details of this community and see what they can tell us about the world of the Dead Sea Scrolls. So we've got this picture of Qumran emerging. Not just a hiding place for scrolls, but a whole community. What's the first thing that jumps out about them when you look at the archaeology?
Well, one of the most striking features is the sheer number of ritual baths these mikvot found throughout the site. It suggests a community deeply concerned with ritual purity.
It's interesting, right? Because we often think of ancient communities as being, well, kind of dirty.
Mm.
But these folks at Qumran were meticulously cleaning themselves all the time. What was that all about?
It goes beyond simple hygiene. They believed that ritual purity was essential for maintaining their covenant with God and preparing for the coming messianic age. Think of it as a way of separating themselves from the perceived impurities of the world around them.
So it's a spiritual cleansing, a way of drawing closer to God. And speaking of their beliefs, we need to talk about the scrolls themselves. It's not just biblical text, right?
You're right. About a quarter of the scrolls are biblical, which is amazing in itself. But the rest are these sectarian texts unique to the Qumran community. And they give us a fascinating window into their worldview.
What are some of the key themes that pop up in these sectarian texts?
There's a huge emphasis on covenant and Torah study. They saw themselves as the true keepers of God's law. They even had their own version of the Torah, the temple scroll, that outlined their vision for an ideal temple and its rituals.
So they weren't just passively studying the scriptures. They were actively interpreting them, applying them to their lives, and even envisioning a new future based on their understanding. That's pretty radical.
It is. And it gets even more intriguing. They called themselves the sons of Zadok, claiming a lineage back to Zadok, the high priest who served King Solomon.
Wait, hold on. Who is Zadok and why was this lineage so important to them?
Zadok was seen as a symbol of priestly legitimacy and purity. By associating themselves with him, the Qumran community was essentially claiming that they were the true heirs to the priesthood, not the priests serving in the Jerusalem temple.
So they saw themselves as a kind of shadow priesthood operating outside the official system. They must have had some serious issues with the way things were being run in Jerusalem.
Absolutely. They viewed the Jerusalem temple and its priesthood as corrupt, and they believed they were the righteous remnant who would restore Israel to its former glory.
And this idea of being a righteous remnant, a chosen group set apart, seems to be a recurring theme in their writings, right?
You're spot on. They believed they were living in the end times, preparing for a cosmic battle between the forces of good and evil.
Which brings us to the War Scroll, a text that's captured the imagination of a lot of people. It lays out a pretty intense vision of this apocalyptic showdown, doesn't it?
It does. It describes in vivid detail a battle between the Sons of Light, representing the Qumran community, and the Sons of Darkness, who represent all the forces opposed to God.
I've got to ask, do you think they literally believed this battle would happen? Or was it more of a symbolic representation of their struggle against evil?
That's a question that scholars are still debating. Some argue that the War Scroll reflects a genuine belief in an impending physical conflict, while others see it as more of a metaphorical representation of their spiritual battle.
It's fascinating either way, right? It gives us a glimpse into their mindset, their sense of urgency and purpose. But this whole idea of sons of light versus sons of darkness, it seems pretty dualistic. Did they believe in a clear-cut division between good and evil?
It certainly seems that way. They saw themselves as the embodiment of righteousness chosen by God to fight against the forces of wickedness.
And this sense of being chosen, of being set apart, might explain why they chose to live in such an isolated location away from the mainstream Jewish community.
That's one possible interpretation. They may have seen separation as a way to preserve their purity and avoid the corrupting influences of the outside world.
But were they completely cut off? Or do they have any interaction with other Jewish groups?
That's hard to say for sure, but remember, they weren't living in a vacuum. They were still part of the broader Jewish world, even if they chose to live on the fringes.
Okay, so we have this picture of a community deeply devoted to scripture, obsessed with purity, and anticipating an apocalyptic showdown. But who exactly were these people? Were they Essenes, as some scholars believe? Or is there more to the story?
Okay, so the Essenes are the main suspects. But I've also heard some scholars argue that the Qumran community might have been Sadducees. What makes you lean towards the Essene theory?
Well, it's not a simple answer. And you're right, there are other interpretations out there. But several things point towards the Essenes.
For one, ancient writers like Pliny the Elder and Josephus described a group called the Essenes who lived a communal lifestyle, emphasized ritual purity, and held beliefs about the end times that resonate with what we see at Qumran.
So we have these independent accounts from ancient sources that seem to match up with the archaeological evidence and the scrolls themselves. That's pretty compelling.
It is.
But is there anything in the scrolls that specifically mentions the Essenes by name?
Unfortunately, no. And that's part of what makes this whole debate so intriguing.
Right.
We have to piece together the evidence from multiple sources and try to connect the dots. It's like a historical jigsaw puzzle.
But wouldn't it be amazing if we found a scroll that just straight up said, hey, you were the Essenes?
Right.
That would solve the mystery, right?
It would certainly make things easier. But even without that smoking gun, the evidence pointing towards the Essenes is pretty strong. And it makes sense when you think about their beliefs and practices. They were deeply concerned with purity. They believed in a coming messianic age. And they separated themselves from what they saw as the corruption of mainstream Judaism. It's not hard to imagine them seeking refuge in a place like Qumran.
And their writings suggest they were very organized, almost like a monastic order, with a strict rule of life.
Absolutely. One of the key texts we find at Qumran is the community rule, which outlines the rules and regulations for members of the community. It covers everything from dietary restrictions to procedures for settling disputes to punishments for transgressions. It paints a picture of a highly structured community with a clear hierarchy and a strong emphasis on discipline and obedience.
So it's like their constitution, laying out the ground rules for how to live the Qumran life.
Exactly.
And did everyone in the community have to follow these rules? Or were there different levels of membership?
The community rules suggest there were different levels of commitment. Some members might have lived at Qumran full time, while others may have been affiliated with the community, but lived elsewhere. And joining the community was a serious undertaking. It involved a probationary period and a series of oaths.
It sounds almost like joining a secret society.
There was definitely a sense of exclusivity and secrecy surrounding the community, and this idea of being set apart, chosen by God, might have made membership all the more appealing.
It makes you wonder what daily life was like at Qumran. What'd they do all day?
Based on the archaeological evidence and the scrolls, it seems their days were structured around prayer, study work, and communal meals.
Okay.
They had a scriptorium where they copied and preserved texts, workshops for crafts and agriculture, and a refectory where they ate together.
So a blend of spiritual and practical activities. And speaking of their spirituality, I'm curious about their messianic beliefs. You mentioned earlier that they believed in two messiahs.
Right.
Can you elaborate on that?
It's one of the most unique aspects of their theology. They anticipated the arrival of both a priestly messiah, descended from Aaron, and a royal messiah, descended from King David. They believed these two figures would work together to usher in the messianic age.
So it was a kind of dual leadership, both spiritual and political, that they were hoping for.
And did they have any ideas about when these messiahs might appear? Were they actively looking for signs?
They certainly believed the messianic age was imminent, and their apocalyptic expectations might have intensified in response to the political turmoil and Roman oppression they were experiencing.
That makes sense. When you feel like the world is falling apart, it's natural to look for a savior, someone who will set things right.
Right.
And their apocalyptic vision is laid out in vivid detail in the War Scroll, right?
Exactly. The War Scroll describes this epic battle between the sons of light and the sons of darkness. That will mark the beginning of the Messianic Age. It's a fascinating text full of symbolism and imagery that reflects their worldview and their hopes for the future.
It's like their version of the Lord of the Rings, but with even higher stakes.
It's a great analogy. And just like in The Lord of the Rings, there's a sense of good ultimately triumphing over evil, of a new era of peace and justice being established. It's a powerful message of hope, even amidst the darkness and uncertainty they were facing. But sadly, their community at Qumran didn't last forever.
No, it didn't.
What happened to them?
In 68 AD, during the first Jewish-Roman War, Roman forces destroyed Qumran. We don't know the exact fate of the community, but it's likely many of them perished during the fighting. or were scattered in the aftermath.
It's a tragic end to their story, but their legacy lives on in the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Absolutely. These texts provide a window into a world we would have otherwise known very little about. They challenge our assumptions about the diversity of Judaism and early Christianity, and they force us to confront the complex historical and religious landscape of the time.
It's like they've given us a key to unlock a hidden chapter in history. And they remind us that even the most carefully constructed communities, the most deeply held beliefs, can be swept away by the tides of time.
And yet the ideas they preserved, the hopes they expressed, continue to resonate with us today. They invite us to reflect on our own beliefs, our own search for meaning, and our own place in the grand sweep of history.
It's incredible to think that these scrolls, hidden away in caves for centuries, have had such a profound impact on our understanding of the past.
I know, it's amazing.
And it makes you wonder what other secrets might be out there waiting to be discovered.
Here's a final thought for you to consider.
Okay.
The Dead Sea Scrolls have given us a glimpse into the world of Second Temple Judaism, but they've also raised a whole new set of questions. What other communities might have existed during this period, holding beliefs and practices that differed from the mainstream? What other texts might be waiting to be unearthed, offering new perspectives on this pivotal era in history? It's an exciting prospect, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's a reminder that there's always more to learn, more to explore. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into the Dead Sea Scrolls. We hope you've gained a deeper appreciation for these remarkable texts and the community that produced them. And who knows, maybe this is just the beginning of your own journey of discovery.